Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Kat Coder, who is currently based in Miami and does work as a sacred psychologist. She also leads ceremonies and works with the elements as well. And yeah, just thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure and honor and to be part of this beautiful unfolding that you've been weaving together.
Yeah, so I guess I often like to start with people's titles because I think it's always interesting. So you said sacred psychologist, and I know that you also have a doctorate. So I am really curious to hear, how you came about that term and how that plays into the work that you do.
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually studied transpersonal psychology, and that's what my doctorate is in. So my training and my education in that field was really avant-garde in many ways. It was transformative education model, and we were our own guinea pigs. So in a sense, I feel like the transpersonal psychology field harkens back to more ancient times when healers were people who were healing themselves. And in the process of healing themselves, perhaps had something to offer other people who might need their assistance or need support in different areas. And so I think transpersonal psychology has been a great platform for me to explore the connection between spirituality, spirit, and healing, and what it means for people to contact the deepest parts of themselves and access these deepest parts of themselves in order to grow and flourish and weave together their own self, but from a much more profound place. And I started ceremony work, let me think. Well, it's been a long time. It's been, well, probably some of my girlfriends and I would get together and just create our own spontaneous ceremonies around different things for fun, starting about 10 years ago. And then I've realized for about 20 years that I've been very drawn to indigenous healing modalities and technologies and indigenous philosophy and orientation and life practice. And so I began studying with Melodoma Patrice Somme, and I think it was at that point that I really started deepening in the practice of ceremony and understanding like the elements that needed to be present and how to create the sacred structure and the safe space. And that work, after 4 years of that work, I evolved into working with sacred plants, eventually leading my own plant ceremonies with psilocybin mushrooms. And I was really creating ceremony, helping provide a safe container and a transformative sacred space for people to go into and gather what they needed for themselves in order to be more whole or to feel their wholeness more. And the term sacred psychologist felt like this natural unfolding from all of this ceremonial work that I've been doing, because I don't consider that I heal anyone. I don't create change for people. What I do at my best is create a container and create a space that's fertile and nourishing and provocative so that people themselves can access parts of themselves or wisdom, truth, beauty, whatever it is that they need, that their soul is longing for, so that they can be begin to put their own pieces together. And then I am blessed to sit in a space to witness that. And so I guess the term sacred psychologist really encapsulates all of that. It's the creation of the sacred space and acting in co-creation with that, with the people that want to show up for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like, you know, it's just worth naming that this, what you're speaking of is different than I think the way most people consider what healing is and consider what the role of the psychologist is. And I'm curious for yourself, like, is that something that always felt true, or did you come upon that through work? And how do you see, you know, it's sort of like having a foot in both worlds, sort of the model of you sit someone down and you tell them what's wrong with them and tell them what they need to do about it. Versus more what you're speaking of, and kind of, do you feel like those things weave together, or how do you bridge that?
Yeah, I think the two do really go together hand in hand. I find that sometimes there's a more masculine element to my work, more directive, perhaps like making more direct suggestions to folks of things that they might want to consider. And as well as the feminine, receptive, you know, womb-like space where there's this nourishment that's available. I think the two go hand in hand, and there are times for both. And at the same time, it's almost like if you think of the Tao, right, or Taoist practice of some kind, you have the polarities of the yin and yang, but what holds those polarities is a place of non-duality, and that non-duality, if it had a voice, which doesn't so much, right? It's sort of ineffable, but there's this just overarching truth of wholeness and okayness, and all is well. There's nothing wrong. And so it's almost like in my work, I have to hold all of that together, knowing that there is nothing fundamentally wrong. Everything is fine. All is well. Everything is perfect at this more fundamental level. And then at the more relative levels, perhaps in getting into more personal truth rather than absolute truth, there are things that appear to be stressful or concerning or painful. And so, you know, we sort of work from all of these levels at the same time, so that I would hope the messaging that anyone that works with me is not there's something wrong with you. You know, it would be that there's nothing wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And in the space of there being nothing wrong with you, there are interesting things that are arising that seem in conflict with that. And let's dive into those.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's like a very, that's a stance in psychology and clinical psychology that's understood much more from a transpersonal perspective, which isn't necessarily a part of mainstream psychology.
Can you say more about that?
The last part around mainstream psychology?
Yeah. I don't really know the difference.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so I mean, my understanding, if you look at, for instance, APA accredited clinical psychology programs across the United States, there is a standard curriculum that's taught. And so there's a specific way that all APA accredited, which is the highest level of accreditation within the psychology field, a clinical psychology field, there's a certain way that that training is orchestrated and it's standardized essentially across all of these different programs. And that training has, for instance, validated cognitive behavioral therapy as one of the major successful treatments for a number of different conditions. So it doesn't treat everything, but treats a lot of different things, and it's widely used and taught. So I don't necessarily think that a standard cognitive behavioral therapist would come from the approach, a more mystical approach that, you know, all is well, we're the wholeness unfolding itself and enfolding itself over and over again. In the space of that, I'm going to articulate you through a protocol to look at your thoughts and question your thoughts. I mean, perhaps that's the case for some of those practitioners, but for the most part, that level of understanding has been cordoned off into the more like religious or spiritual canons. And so the mainstream field of psychology separates spirituality and religion from the practice of psychology for the most part. Now, times have changed a lot, especially in the last 10 years with the rise of mindfulness and mindfulness being studied at places like UCLA, for instance. And so there's aspects of religious traditions, such as mindfulness, that have now been incorporated into mainstream psychology. But what mainstream psychology is incorporating is not deep existential truth or deep mystical thought. It's just they're incorporating the secularized versions of certain practices. Mm-hmm. So, you know, religion and spirituality is still considered very taboo for most mainstream clinical psychologists in terms of their own. I mean, they may have a personal practice, but they typically don't bring that into the therapeutic container. It would be very uncommon to do that. And it's been said that the reason for that is that clinical psychology has always felt a little, how would I describe that? Insecure in a certain way, comparing itself to more hard sciences like biology or chemistry or physics, and not wanting to be considered a pseudoscience. You know, the mainstream clinical psychology field has really strived to base itself entirely in empirically validated protocols so that they could approach the field of medicine much more than they have in the past. So looking at something like, let's just say, psychoanalysis from Freud or Jung or any of those contemporaries, it would be very difficult to set up an empirically validated study to measure outcomes and practices within psychoanalysis, because those modalities of psychology are so fluid. Hmm. Now, if you can create something like cognitive behavioral therapy, which can be run based on a protocol that can be administered by anyone who's trained in the protocol, and you follow a series of articulated steps over and over again, well, that becomes much easier to measure and test the validity of. So mainstream clinical psychology has trended much more towards types of treatments that can be empirically validated and therefore it covered by insurance agencies. So it's a whole, and everything gets, I wouldn't say that what's happening in clinical psychology is uncommon. That's a general trend that's been happening, I would say, in the medical field as well. And And people are looking for proof, right? People are looking for some proof that something works. And clinical psychology mainstream has wanted to align itself with things that can be proven as effective. And unfortunately, it just leaves out whole swaths of modalities that would be very difficult to research and test and validate, and yet are perhaps very valid forms of treatment, including any hybrid modalities of working with more indigenous or shamanic tools, for instance. So I've just chosen to play in the margins of mainstream psychological practice because I find that I'm much more at home in the margins, and I enjoy the freedom to create from an entire world of healing modalities that becomes available to me if I'm not restricted to those that have been validated in peer-reviewed journals. So I'm having more fun.
Yeah. And I mean, I really resonate with what you were saying at first about how, like, creating that space for people to find the healing in themselves is really at the heart of what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of, it sounds like, you know, sort of trusting that that exists inside of people. And I'm curious about that too. Like, in your work, do you feel like it's, what level of proof or belief or faith or trust is needed for the individual to have that experience? I don't know if that's a question you can answer, but maybe just to speak to, like, your experience with that, like, people at varying levels.
Sure, yeah. And I see people at many different levels too. One of the things that seems important as part of this discussion is this idea of mirroring. And it's been something that I've been looking at a lot and playing with a lot with clients and with myself. And it's really important for us in growing into our wholeness that we have all of these different aspects of ourself mirrored back to us in some way. And sometimes, you know, those mirrors are friends and family. Sometimes it could be a place that we visit, some place that we find really special or sacred, and it mirrors back to us some truth or something that we know, something that we resonate with, something that feels deeply important in some sense or sacred. And sometimes it's the role of a therapist or a guide or a teacher of some kind to hold another kind of mirror where people can then see themselves or see aspects of themselves that they hadn't been able to see before, or they hadn't been able to see them in a way that made a deep enough impression, if that makes sense. And so people come with varying degrees of faith or belief, and depending on how much or how little are the process of us working together is different, right? There's that analogy that Brené Brown uses, this jar with the marbles in it, and sometimes I think faith and belief is like that. If someone is highly traumatized and highly wounded from events perhaps that happened early on in life, then it can take a while to put enough faith marbles in the faith jar for a person to feel that they can dare to trust in something that feels very ephemeral, you know, something that doesn't feel like it can be touched in the material sense, but that they feel. And It's like learning how to walk in the dark or see in the dark, right? So sometimes it can take a while to learn how to see in the dark and trust that it's okay to do that, and to trust that there will be something, signs or little clues or breadcrumbs along the way that pull us forward in our deepening and our understanding. But it does, for a lot of folks that have had a lot of wounding, it takes a long time to believe, and it's very important for them to have this mirroring back to them that validates that it's possible that what they're experiencing is true, or that they can trust in that. They can trust in the subtle, ephemeral breadcrumbs, so to speak.
And so with that, like, I feel like it just brings up that really delicate relationship that you build in that process of healing someone else, where, you know, you're really wanting to make space for them to feel empowered within themselves, but also not abandoned. And I'm just curious how you've wrestled with that.
Yeah, I've had to really learn to trust the information that I'm receiving. That's been a really important part of my process, and I feel like there have been a number of clients. Spirit has delivered me just the right clients to help me trust myself, to help me trust in knowing when to push a little bit and when to lean back and when to perhaps offer more directive guidance or directive suggestion, and when to just rest in silence. And it's been a huge process for me personally in learning how to hold space and how to co-create sacred space. And I'm sure it's a teaching that I will be learning for the rest of my life. I just learn more and more about that and grow in my subtle awareness, and can notice when I've maybe overstepped or understepped. You know, it's kind of a little dance I'm in when I'm working with someone. And also just, you know, there's an important process for me around attuning and allowing my mind to be clear and being able to notice what's arising inside of me in response to a client, and then responding from that space. Sometimes clients evoke parts of my own process that I'm still feel very unfinished in. And, you know, I could, if I wasn't careful, could start to respond from my own personal process rather than responding from a deeper relationship with my client. So I have to be very careful about keeping noticing and witnessing my process unfolding while keeping some distance from it, so that I'm wholly available to the person that I'm working with. And keeping that, like, that the container and the hygiene and asking, I mean, I spend a lot of time asking Spirit for support, you know, help me, Spirit, understand and support this person. And then I listen, you know, I ask for the assistance and the guidance from Spirit, and then I listen. And that deep listening, it's like when it happens, it's magical. It's like, it just is so perfect. So I think I'm learning more and more when I'm in that magical river and when I'm kind of slightly off to one side. So that helps me a lot in sitting with people. And a lot of my work really is guiding people through their own intuitive processes and meditative states and using more shamanic tools and rattling and singing and drumming and, you know, working with different herbs and things like that. And so the clients themselves come to their own conclusions through these processes. So they're constantly feeling like their own being is integrating something for itself. It's not me feeding them information. It's that their own deeper sense of self, or their higher self, or their soul self, or whatever you want to call it, that's helping them see certain things. And so I feel like when that kind of process is unfolding for someone, they know that I'm not giving them this information. It's like, no, your being is giving you this information. I'm just a part of the process of helping create the space where your deeper self can give you that. And so that it creates a lot of, I would say, ease in my relationship with clients. And I don't find that I nurture a lot of like dependency, if that makes sense. Like I'm supportive and I'm nurturing, but I'm also creating environments where the client can feel empowered themselves, because ultimately they are the ones that are going to make the changes in their lives. Well, I can't make any changes for anyone in their life. So I have to support it. I'm in integrity if I support a process where they become more and more trusting in their own wisdom and their own self.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's really important for you to say that, because I think there's been a long history of spiritual teachers and even psychologists probably that do foster a dependency that can be harmful. And I'm curious too, in terms, I mean, you're using the word shaman or shamanistic, and I feel like that's a word that gets used a lot, and maybe people don't really know exactly what it means. So I'm curious, and I guess it also has a lot of different meanings for different people. So I'm curious what it is for you, like how you make that distinction.
Yes. Yes, and I am so torn with that word. I just have to put that out there. It's really don't I struggle with that word, actually. I mean, shaman comes from the Siberian saman, and it was a medicine person. The medicine person for the village was described as a I don't know if in Siberian it's actually the H is pronounced or not, but it's SAMAN. And then that term, I think, through anthropology got picked up and thrown around, and then actually was adopted by a lot of Latin American traditions in South America. They use that term all the time. Shaman, you know, chamanismo. So it's sort of been like appropriated and reappropriated and you know, over and over again. And so it's the, you know, I feel like each person is coming to their own understanding. Obviously in indigenous or original cultures, the medicine person would have a specific name that would be tied to whatever language it comes from. And so I feel like the word shaman is just a placeholder for whatever that would be. But the way that I see that, and I do, you know, there's a way that I do see more holistic psychologists as modern day shamans, in the sense that they're bridging worlds. They're bridging a world of the unseen and the seen, for instance. And especially if a psychologist has more of a transpersonal leaning, where they're bridging the psychological, the spiritual, and the material, then they're a lot of times like playing in this realm that medicine people have played in. And there are all kinds of different medicine people. I mean, there are people that just work with herbs. There are people that just work with divination. You know, there are people that have different roles working with talismans. And so there's a lot of specializations within the medicine person world as well. But I think, yeah, when I say shamanistic, I guess I mean opening to spirit and opening to using technologies that have been used for thousands and thousands of years to create environments, sacred spaces that people find themselves healing inside of. So if I'm sitting there speaking to a person more in a talk therapy mode, I wouldn't really consider that shamanistic. Maybe that's limiting of me or short-sighted. But I would say when I'm drumming and singing and working with different herbs and the Palo Santo and guiding people through altered states of consciousness in order to have deeper parts of themselves reveal themselves, and I feel like that's much more shamanistic. And certainly if I'm creating a ceremony and working with altars and working with the energy and working with movement and all of those other things, like, then that feels much more shamanistic to me. It feels older. It just feels more ancient. So yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I think that it's like you said, it's a hard word, that a lot of things get associated with it. And you know, you also mentioned that you had been facilitating like plant ceremonies and sort of speaking about like the ancient technologies. And it's interesting because I think at the same time there is a movement within maybe definitely alternative psychology, but still people trying to do, you know, scientific studies about that experience and how it can be healing for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, and it's very tricky, right? Because so many people have such negative relationships to substances, and it can, obviously they put you in a really vulnerable state. So I'm just curious, like, how that's evolved for you and what role you feel like it plays or should play in people's healing process.
Yeah, it's interesting. And that's, I think we've spoken a little bit about New Orleans, but certainly in Miami, there are so many ceremonies. I mean, just even between ayahuasca and San Pedro, there's so many ceremonies every weekend now, and lots of shamans coming up from South America, Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, Peru, you know, and so it's become like a huge part of the spiritual landscape here in Miami for sure.
Mm-hmm. Definitely and, here too.
Yeah. Yeah, right. We're like coastal cities in the South, you know. So it's a tricky issue for me. When I started working with plants, I had been on the spiritual path for 15 years or something, and I had developed myself in a meditation practice. I had gone through 5 years of transpersonal psychology, guinea pig training, and gone through so much therapy, and I had done so much other work. I had worked with Maladoma. I'd worked in ritual space, you know, so I kind of had all of these pieces personally going into working with plants. And I found it really helpful. And I decided to work with plants personally because I felt like there were things in my psyche that I just could not get access to any other way. And I had gone through a spiritual awakening process, and I finally felt like I was ready to put myself in that kind of vulnerable state where this sort of deeper shadow material could arise and I could work on healing it. And so that was my personal motivation around it. I have friends and colleagues at between NYU and Johns Hopkins that are working in psychedelic psychotherapy, for instance, and different protocols around working with psilocybin and MDMA, and particularly psilocybin. And one of the things, and maybe it's just because I have all this psychology background and the training, that I really appreciate about the studies that are being done at places like Johns Hopkins and NYU, is that, yes, they're offering participants in the studies flood doses of psilocybin, but they're offering them flood doses of psilocybin as part of a longer, you know, 14-week, more or less, training or protocol, treatment protocol. So they prepare people going into the ceremony, and then they, and it's not really a ceremony even, it's because it's very secular, going into the experience of working with psilocybin. And then they have sessions afterwards where they help people process and integrate what they've learned. And then they prepare people again for the second psilocybin immersion experience. And then on the back end, they help them integrate everything that's come through. And so over the course of 14 to 16 weeks, they of intensive work, they really hold people through an entire process of going so deep with a psychedelic experience and getting the most out of it. So I really respect those kinds of treatment protocols and treatment approaches, because I feel intuitively, like the feminine part of myself, the part of myself that wants people to feel really held, that wants people to feel really safe, that gets taken care of, like that safety issue, the containment, and honestly, the responsibility of someone who's offering something like that, a psychedelic that can literally fracture someone psychologically. You know, they're really containing those experiences, and therefore they have a lot of positive results as part of their therapeutic protocol. People are really responding beautifully to that kind of work. And sometimes I feel at odds with how certain shamans, quote unquote, or medicine people that are coming from the South are functioning, because it feels, in a way, it's like I'm calling it missionary medicine. So they come for a night or two nights, and then they're off to some other city, and then they're off to some other city, and then they might come back around. But who is preparing these folks who are going to these ceremonies? Like, who's preparing them really for the level, I mean, of depth, profundity of these, for instance, an ayahuasca experience? Are people really being adequately prepared for it? Are people integrating the experience afterwards adequately before going right into another ceremony? And I don't really see the same level of containment or holding in the more, I don't know what you would call it, a more sort of like grassroots ceremonial circles. And I also see people getting very involved in those circles. And that's something that I did as well, because I wanted to be part of a supportive tribe. I wanted to feel like I belong to something and have that containment in a certain way, just at the level of being in a group with someone and sharing this passion. But I often wonder if this is the best way for folks to achieve healing. I mean, it's certainly, the word best is really problematic, but is this the most wise? Is this a wise approach? It's much easier in a way for me after my 4 years of experience and my training to get behind a Johns Hopkins version where there's a protocol and there's a lot of holding and there's a lot of integrating afterwards and preparation. And in a way that feels very sacred to me because there's attention that's been placed on all of these different elements that then can help people arrive more deeply inside themselves. And I feel less comfortable with the itinerant South American shaman who isn't available for people if they're struggling afterwards or if they have questions or they don't understand how to integrate the teachings into their life and are sort of just left, you know, it's up to them to figure it out. And I'm sure you have your own experiences around this too. Obviously, I think there's a lot of good that comes through in these ceremonies. And my personal, like, deepest desire is for people to have much greater holding around those experiences. I'm still working with teachings that I received 4 years ago from ayahuasca, and I'll be working with them for the rest of my life.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely agree that there is, like, with the proliferation and the popularity, there's harm being done. And it's like there is a need to be, I think just more careful, because it's powerful, you know, it's because you see, yep. Because it's effective, you know,
it's so powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the power I feel like is much greater if the experience is really held deeply.
Mm-hmm. Like, and maybe this is hard to answer, but I'm curious if you have any sense of like what you feel people are really looking for, or like any sense of why this popularity has grown so much in this moment, you know, with all the things that are going on in the world.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. I mean, I've had different answers to that question at different times too. I mean, at one point I was really convinced that ayahuasca was this like masterful social activist, you know, just like, I'm going to be everywhere, you know, just wait and waking people up, honestly, shaking people awake. I wrote my dissertation on spiritually awakened social change agents. And one of the terms that came through for an Indigenous woman that I studied was this concept of shaking the world awake, like shaking the world awake. And so sometimes I felt like ayahuasca is like this, like she's kind of just like, wake up, wake up. It's time to wake up, you know, it's time to get out of bed. It's time to, you know, be on top of things and see what's going on. And when I drill down into that for myself, and when I feel into, for instance, the ayahuasca experience, and I think it could be said of a lot of the different plant teachers, is it's a deep remembering. And it's an experience of deep, deep remembering, one that's so deep that sometimes you can't even really put words to it, but you know in the very core of your being, in every fiber of your being, what's true and what's not true. And I feel like, really need to be reminded of that right now, because it's very confusing out there. And we're getting bombarded with all kinds of different information. You know, some of it is for our good and some of it is not. And to have the inner strength and clarity to be able to sift through the mayhem that exists around us and live from our deepest place of peace and wisdom and truth and beauty, you know, that's a tall order these days. And so I think a lot of people, whether they're conscious of it or unconscious of it, I mean, they're struggling with that. You know, we've been born from the baby boomer generation who like threw out a lot of their parents' understanding and yet have, you know, the baby boomers are pretty entitled in a way. And we are facing levels of scarcity on this planet that our human population hasn't experienced in recent memory. So we've got a whole environmental collapse thing that we're dealing with that our parents really didn't have to deal with. I'm speaking from my generation. You know, I'm 37, so I can't speak for everyone, but at least in my generation, this is how I understand it. And I think a lot of people younger than me are even more aware of the environmental degradation and the seriousness of what's at stake right now. And I don't mean to be alarmist, but it's kind of like all hands on deck. Whatever gets us, like whatever gets us to the place where we feel like we can have agency, that we feel like we have power, that we have, but not just power coming from some egoic delusion, but power that's coming from something much, much deeper. And I think that ayahuasca, for better or for worse, I mean, obviously for better, in my opinion, is waking people up to the consciousness of the earth, the elements, the consciousness of life itself. And that's information that a lot of people really need. And it's not information like, oh, I read the news, you know, and this is what's going on in Syria right now. It's like this deep wisdom type of information and knowledge, I guess I should call it knowledge, that a lot of people need to be awakened to as well. And it's just sort of shaking us awake out of delusion, out of sleep, out of hiding. And I mean, I worked with Iboga, I went through a couple of Iboga ceremonies, and you know, that's all about the truth. And the truth is not often pleasant. It's not pleasant, but the truth is the truth, and it's unassailable. And that's the kind of bedrock that we need right now in order to know how to act, and even how to think, and how to feel. And so I think these different helpers or technologies, whatever you want to call them, arise when the need is there. And I think the need is there right now. And I think people are responding to that need.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, in thinking about all the different things that can be awakened in that experience, I'm curious, like, how...
It's definitely not the only way. And, it's not, I think for a lot of people, it's not even the best way. For a number of my clients, I would never recommend ayahuasca because they don't have the preparation for it. They don't have some kind of personal practice of studying themselves. And some people, it's risky. And sometimes it's not really worth the risk. I find that there are other ways that are more gentle. And even in the work that I do, I'm certainly not going to, you know, meaning to like compare myself to ayahuasca or the work that I do, but working through hypnotic states, working slightly under the normal state of consciousness where, you know, you're a dream weaver, working in a way through these kinds of visions that arise out of our deepest parts of ourselves that show us certain things. You know, working through somatic-based therapies, going into the body itself and allowing the body to speak. You know, the body tends to be very instinctual, very rooted, very grounded, and a lot of truth comes right out of the body, and it's you don't really question it because you just know what's true. It resonates at such a deep level. And so there are all sorts of, you know, dreamlike visions that arise out of our consciousness naturally. And there are a number of ways of tapping into them. And, you know, people find truth in many different places. And I like to say, and I think it's really true, that if we all spent more time in nature, that there would be no need for me and what I do. I wouldn't need to do what I do if we all just were in nature more and had access to being led and being taught and being guided by by Mother Nature herself. I mean, I think part of our confusion arises from the fact that we tend to live lives that for a lot of us are very disconnected from the wild. I mean, the wilds of nature. I mean, where are the wild places, you know, that are unpopulated and unsettled and that speak to this, I don't even know how to describe it, this part of ourself that is undefined, you know, and is raw and natural. And so I think going to places like that and spending time in nature is really fundamentally important for health and well-being. And I think having community that supports you in your deeper unfolding, whatever that looks like, is also really important, because there's strength in numbers, you know, and if we're going against an entire system, then it's very hard to do that by oneself. Is it possible? Yes. Is it more challenging? Yes. So, you know, people have visionary states that arise in meditation, you know, in dance, in drumming, and listening to music. So many ways in. It just takes the commitment to go in. I think that's the more difficult thing, is knowing how to go, which to choose, and then committing to doing that. It's available. All of these modalities are available.
Yeah. So on that, and just sort of like for anyone listening, who maybe is wanting to start that journey, like where do you think, where do you point people who are just at the beginning, and where can they start tapping into these more natural ways of healing themselves?
Yeah, I think there are a number of different ways, and I like to advise people to follow what feels interesting to them, what feels good to them. I mean, for one person that might be doing the artist's way, you know, and beginning to tap into their creativity, you know. For another person that might be taking a painting class or a dance class or signing up for, you know, training in meditation or participating in, you know, a woman's gathering, a new moon or a full moon gathering. I mean, there are, I think for a lot of people in Miami, it's yoga. I mean, yoga has been their entry point to these deeper life teachings. And so I feel like, I mean, if I look at it, it feels like yoga really draws a lot of people, and meditation can draw a lot of people as well. But for me, I like to recommend, it's like following your heart. Like, what's something that you've always been kind of longing for, or jonesing for, or curious about? Or maybe there's something that you did as a child, like that you really just loved, and you'd like to get back to that. I like to think of us as, we each have our own unique native language. Like, each person has their own language. And a lot of our languages have become endangered because no one ever spoke to us in our language, and we never learned it. And therefore it's even lost to us in a way. And so part of this deeper inward journey of self-discovery and awakening is around beginning to access our own language, you know, our own frequency, and playing with that and exploring that. And I can imagine the work that you do with dreams is also very tied into this kind of thing as well, and helping people access deeper parts of themselves. But to honor the self as a guide, to say, you know what, I've always wanted to take that West African dance class, and I probably will like be an idiot out there, but something in it is calling me. It's like, what's calling you? You know, what's calling or what's been calling? What have you been like, nah, no, I don't want to do that. You know, you haven't responded to the call, but like if we think about it, I think for almost every person, like there's been something that's called them that maybe they haven't said yes to and they haven't responded to the call, but there's been a call. So it's hard to say what that is for each person, but the soul calls. The soul will call. It will say, hey, where are you at?
Yeah. So is there anything else you wanted to add or mention?
I think there's a place of just for me wanting to mention how important the journey home is, and home in the larger sense. And I just want to encourage anyone who's listening who doesn't feel like they're home yet to just keep going, to keep exploring, to keep experimenting, to keep taking chances and being courageous and daring to take that next step towards themselves, to find this place of deep rest and deep peace and profound creativity and joy and wonder. It's there. It does exist. And I want people to know that they have support. There are a lot of forces that are supporting that process, and I'm certainly sending a lot of good energy that way to support people in finding their way home, and just sending lots of blessings and lots of love for anyone that's seeking that.
Well, thank you so much. It was really fun.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you holding this space. It's